The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin. Winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
I've been now president for over 7 years, and gun sales don't seem to have suffered during that time.
If anything, actually, you've helped.
They've gone up. I've been very good for gun manufacturers.
There it is right there. The grim irony and apparent contradiction of the Obama legacy on gun control. Lots of passion about excessive access to guns and rising sales of firearms at the same time.
There's nothing else in our lives that we purchase where we don't try to make it a little safer if we can. Traffic fatalities have gone down drastically during my lifetime. And part of it is technology, and part of it is that the National Highway Safety Administration does research and they figure out, you know what, seatbelts really work. And then we pass some laws to make sure seatbelts are fastened.
The president was at the center of a CNN Anderson Cooper town hall meeting last night at George Mason University. He called out the NRA for not attending, although representatives of gun retailers did attend. And let's listen now to the town hall meeting still going on among our listeners.
My name is John Oxford in Oklahoma City. I own a firearm because there are people that are criminals that would use firearms to harm others, and I want to be able to protect myself in the same manner, to meet fire with fire.
Hi, I'm Jason. I'm from Maine. And up here, law enforcement response times are sometimes in excess of half an hour, sometimes as much as an hour. So going off of that, I'm my own first responder.
The best armed civilian population in the world has more guns than people. But does that make us lucky in this country? Rape victim Kimberly Corbin did not feel lucky last night at the town hall meeting at George Mason.
Why can't your administration see that these restrictions that you're putting to make it harder for me to own a gun or harder for me to take that where I need to be is actually just making my kids and I less safe?
Let's turn now to Bishop Douglas Miles, a pastor at Koinonia Baptist Church and co-chair emeritus of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. He was in attendance at the town hall last night. Welcome back to the show, Pastor. And what was it like there in the town hall last night?
It was a great experience. Tense times at moments, and the aftermath was almost chaos in the studio.
Because chaos, why?
Opponents and proponents going at each other.
Now, do you think that's a good thing? Is that a good thing, or is that a sign of gridlock and divisiveness?
Some gridlock and divisiveness, but in some instances we were able to find common ground, especially the Do Not Stand Idly By campaign, which I'm a part of, has found common ground with the National Retailers Association of Gun Dealers and have agreed to look at ways that we can work together around this whole issue.
What do you think the likelihood is of talk becoming action from last night's events?
I think we're on to something, especially in looking at the role that gun distributors can play in this whole violence epidemic that we're facing. And also pointing a finger at the gun manufacturers and what they're not doing and could do to help stem some of the violence in this nation.
Now, what can the manufacturers do? I mean, guns are supposed to shoot, and therefore, you know, anything that makes them not shoot would make them not worth anything.
There are two areas that the gun manufacturers can be instrumental. One, in moving ahead in smart gun technology, which produces guns that can only be fired by the person who owns the gun. Secondly, in terms of producing smart locks that can be used on virtually any guns, and those instruments are available now, so that children can't accidentally shoot themselves. People who steal guns would not be able to use those guns if they were appropriately locked. And thirdly, the gun manufacturers can play a significant role in identifying the 1% of bad dealers who are selling up to 60% of the guns that are found at the scenes of homicides and suicides.
What do you think of his answer to this woman who was raped and who believes that you know, the things that he's doing, that the president is actually doing, Kimberly Corbin believes make her less safe.
And that's what I mean by the emotion attached to it. Nothing the president has suggested would in any way take away her right to own a gun, her right to have that gun in her home to protect herself and her family. Nothing that he has proposed even hints at restricting law-abiding citizens from being able to possess and weapons.
Now, the cynical viewer here would say, you know, we're a big country, upwards of, 300 million people. I mean, this is a sideshow of a sideshow of a sideshow in terms of where Americans mostly stand in terms of taking action here. That's got to feel like an uphill battle.
I really think the converse is true, and the media, I don't think, is doing an adequate job in putting responsibility where it needs to go. There's a silent majority in the NRA that needs to start speaking up so that the NRA leadership is put in check and blocking Congress from doing what needs to be done to strengthen background check laws and moving in other directions. No right-minded, law-abiding citizen wants to reduce background checks that enable criminals to possess weapons. So that's one area that needs to happen. That silent majority, I hate to use Nixon's term, but that silent majority of NAR members needs to start speaking up to its leadership saying, back off. This is something that needs to happen in this nation.
Bishop Douglas Miles is a pastor at Koinonia Baptist Church and co-chair emeritus of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, in attendance at the town hall meeting on Thursday night. And what's the name of your organization focused specifically on this issue?
It's Metro IAF Do Not Stand Idly By campaign.
Thank you so much, Bishop.
Thank you.
And now let's hear a little more from the hundreds of people who reached out to us over the past 24 hours to find common ground and express their own feelings. Here's one of them. Aaron Wood, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Now tell me a little bit about you.
I was raised in a home in rural Virginia where we maintained a 22 rifle for the sole purposes of managing farm life. And that home was very much anti-gun. The thought was, why in the world would we do this? People who maintain guns really don't have a strong sense of what it means to be in the one human family. Several years ago, my biological father died, and he left two guns, one my other sister took and one I took. And so that's how I came to be an owner of my current firearm. And I also, prior to that time, a couple years prior to that time, the father of my son is a proponent of gun ownership, responsible gun ownership, if I need to use that clarifier. And when we began to live together and started talking about the role of guns in our home, knowing that we were going to have a child, I had many, many discussions with him about what sorts of guns would be there and why would they be there. And so we settled on having the single firearm in the home that he felt most comfortable with because he wanted to be able to defend our home. Since that time, we are no longer together, and we live in separate homes. And so when I got my gun from my father, it felt to me like it would be appropriate for my home to also have a firearm to defend ourselves should we need it. And yet at the same time, I had a great dissonance because I felt like I shouldn't have something with that much deadly capability if I didn't know how to use it well. In fact, I will be attending a day-long concealed carry permit class with a certification process at the end at the range with that particular gun, but I will also be taking with me a semi-automatic pistol.
All right, so your self-examination led you to actually increase your connection to a firearm and actually go about getting a conceal and carry permit. Now, what do you make of the president's suggestions that there need to be safety mechanisms on guns, that gun manufacturers need to be potentially liable for mass shootings, and some of the kinds of changes that were talked about last night?
I cannot imagine why we would not want to use available technology to increase the safety of firearms. But I think that's not the same thing as thinking that those sorts of technologies will be mandatory on all firearms. I think there might be a feeling among some people that there won't be sort of what I would presume to be a grandfather space, where people who have guns will then all of a sudden have to return to their gun shop and get these biometric whatever sort of technologies on them. And I understand why people would be worried about that.
Well, you're very thoughtful about this. Do you think the NRA has overreached in its political agenda? And would you think of yourself as, you know, a member of the silent majority that really wants a more responsible message coming from groups like the NRA?
I have not been on the NRA's website. I have not read their white papers or their mission statements. I'm not sure that I have to, because their position, so far as I can tell, is to maximize access to firearms. And that's problematic to me. If the NRA were to say, we want our membership to be comprised of responsible gun owners, and then define responsible as people who are intentional about their relationship to firearms, then they would lose a lot of their membership. One of the issues is if we define a responsible gun owner, if the definition of that individual is somebody who, say, has gone through a certification process, whether that be a concealed carry process or some other course, the concealed carry course here in North Carolina is 8 hours of in-class time plus a couple hours on the gun range with a level of proficiency and performance in shooting. If an individual walks away from that and determines themselves an expert, then we have a problem. That's not expert level. But many people do walk away and feel like, oh, because I've been certified, therefore I am responsible. And yet, I teach psychology, I teach behavior modification. We are so prone to overconfidence when we know very little. It is only when we dig deeper and deeper do we understand what we don't know, do we understand the limitations on our capabilities. And when it comes to fine motor coordination and the skill that it takes to properly handle a firearm, that takes many, many hours of intentional practice.
Well, Aaron, we'll see where it comes out. I mean, I think the remarkable takeaway here from this conversation is, okay, the president may jar people into thinking more responsibly and deeply about what they should do regarding gun violence and their connection to firearms. But the outcome of that journey may have some surprises. I think it's a fascinating journey. And Aaron, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be on your show.
While President Obama seems to be dedicating the rest of his presidency to making Americans more safe from gun violence, he also seems determined to send civilians trying to escape the worst gun violence in the world back to a war zone. Criminal gangs and the armed forces of a corrupt state have turned El Salvador into the murder capital of the planet. The Department of Homeland Security is enforcing standing deportation orders against people from Central America who've tried to escape to the United States, people like Martha Maria Hernandez.
It'll be tough, because I cannot go back to what used to be my home. You know about the Maras gang, right? Well, they've threatened me, and in my country, their threats are real. They're not playing games. I'm not going back to where I used to live, but I don't know where I'll end up.
Hernandez is speaking to Texas Standard reporter Emily Donahue from a detention center in Dilley, Texas. Ms. Hernandez was scheduled to fly to El Salvador yesterday morning, but Texas Standard reports her deportation order was halted temporarily by her attorney. Noah Bullock is the executive director of Cristosal, a human rights organization in El Salvador. He says the country is barely recognizable from the civil war years in the 1980s when the U.S. was heavily involved in El Salvador.
Comparing it to the civil war is maybe difficult in the sense that it's a different type of conflict and there's multiple actors involved in the violence. You know, we have a homicide rate nationally of about 104 to every 100,000. And to give you a perspective, the World Health Organization considers an epidemic to be anything above 10 for every 100,000 homicides. And so we have levels of violence that are similar to the Civil War period. Just in the first 3 days of the year, there were 72 people killed.
And is this death squad-like murders, or is this full-fledged chaos between gangs?
I think that narrative of gang conflict is definitely the one that the media whitewashes. But when you look closer at the conflict, I think that there are more actors involved, and that's something that is new this year. We have, for example, state violence, an increase in extrajudicial execution on the part of the police and the military. We have the emergence of death squads, like social cleansing groups. They've taken force in the country. It's not clear who's financing those groups. There's also the traditional actors like the gangs themselves and other trafficking groups that are in conflict. So you have a general environment of impunity in which groups of people can kill, and there's generally no responsibility or accountability for that violence.
What do citizens feel about all of this, just if they're not affiliated with any gang or are trying to live their lives with their heads down?
There's a slogan that they paint on the wall, see, hear, and shut up. I think that that's something that some people have had to do. People who are able to pay for their security do that, and those who can't have to find other means of surviving. I think that's the sad reality. When we think about immigration, for example, people who are deserting schools because of violence, people who can't work because of violence, their mechanism for survival is to leave the country.
And how many are leaving? What we saw in the crisis last year was that it was mostly young families and individuals who are unilaterally going north. Is that still the case?
Unaccompanied minors was the story that captured the headlines, but behind that were also entire family groups that said, life is no longer viable for me in this community and I have to leave. One of the things that victims of violence are experiencing in El Salvador is that the government itself doesn't recognize forced displacement by violence as a problem. And so there aren't direct policies or programs to assist people. So when they don't encounter a solution internally in the country, they cross an international border to seek that protection. And unfortunately, in many cases, if they're heading towards the north, people aren't being treated as subjects of international protection, rather illegal immigrants.
Do the people see that the international community is responding, or do they see themselves lost in a violence that goes unreported?
That's a good way of putting it. People, I think, feel invisible. When they're displaced internally in the country, oftentimes the pattern is that families hide. They go into seclusion until they come to the conclusion that it's no longer viable. I can't develop as a person in these conditions. And then they leave the country and they have to hide from authorities that should protect them. And so this is one of the frustrating truths for families looking for options.
Is there anything in the political situation in El Salvador right now which could address this violence? Anything on the horizon that would attempt to get the country back under government control as opposed to allowing this gang violence to go essentially unchecked?
That's the sad part, is that the way that violence becomes part of an ongoing political conflict between the right and the left. To give you an example, the gangs, in sort of a show of force earlier last year, threatened all the transportation workers and said that if you go out and work today, you and your family will die. And they effectively were able to shut down transportation in the capital and across the country. And the response of the government was, this is a right-wing conspiracy. It's being promoted by our political adversaries. And so politicizing what isn't necessarily a political conflict makes it more difficult to come to real solutions or building more of a consensus around national policy responses.
Noah, before we go, can you give me a sense of a family or an individual who symbolizes to you the sense of loss that you know, a person is going to grow up and become an adult in a country that has no opportunity?
We generally attend to families here, and so when one family member is threatened, usually it's a criminal organization trying to exploit that member by leveraging the lives of the rest of the family. So you have young boys who may be being forcibly recruited to join the ranks of the gang, or young girls who, when they become 12, are given two options. They can either be raped by multiple members of a gang or become the forced girlfriend of one member of the gang. And they say, if you don't choose one of those options, we'll kill your whole family. And so that sense of a family that has nowhere really to turn, no good options. And that is the concept of refugee status, of being a refugee. We have decided as an international community that nobody can be denied a place on earth because of who they are and where they were born. Yet many Central Americans are facing that situation, that if I leave my country, they'll call me illegal. If I stay, the consequences could be very severe for my family.
Noah Bullock is the executive director of Cristosal in El Salvador, a human rights organization. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
President Obama wants action over apathy on gun control. Are you taking a new look at your own relationship to firearms? Why do you own a gun? And if you don't, would you? Alpharetta, Georgia. I don't have a gun, but will be learning to shoot this year and get one for home defense and confidence in long-distance travels. I'm okay with going through safety courses and a background check as I did with getting a driver's license.
Hi, I'm Cynthia calling from Pineville, North Carolina. I am a 55-year-old, single, live-alone woman. I've never owned a gun in my life, nor have I ever been in any sort of confrontation before. However, with all that's going on these days, I must admit I contemplate getting one more and more each day.
It's David Bowie's birthday. Here he is at age 22 on The Dick Cavett Show.
Stars tend to have premonitions of doom. It seems to be a theme in their work and in their life.
Because they're pretty nutty to be doing it in the first place, aren't they?
You know what it is?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever try to picture yourself at 60?
No. <Yeah. laughs>
Cash girl, suffer me. I've got no enemies. I'm walking down.
Well, the Diamond Dog has made it well past 60. He's 69 today, and he's releasing this new album. Bowie has been everywhere and done everything, it seems, in music, on stage, in life. In 1997, you could even buy a Bowie bond on the financial markets. Those bonds traded for 10 years and got the artist an upfront payment of $55 million. Just one way he's changed the music business. A tribute now from Bowie superfan Todd Zwillick.
Now, this might be a controversial statement, and if so, we want to hear from you, of course, but I'm here to tell you that David Bowie is overall the most influential musician alive today. Now, I know you're already thinking, what? Paul McCartney, dude? Bob Dylan?
Oh, baby, just you shut your mouth.
Bowie did more for how rock and roll looks and feels than anyone else. So let's take this point by point. One, musical diversity and longevity. Bowie had huge hits early on with Ziggy Stardust and Rebel Rebel. You still hear those songs today a lot. Now, his old music stands up better than almost anyone else's, but he also put out songs that defined entirely different musical eras like this. Let's Dance, China Girl, Modern Love, these were all era-defining 80s dance songs, and you're still likely to hear them on the radio today. Now, lots of artists still get their 80s songs played on the radio, but Bowie did this nearly 20 years into his career. You could argue that only Queen was more diverse and eclectic in their successful output, but of course Freddie Mercury is no longer with us. And all this from the guy who wrote Space Oddity, which is basically a folk song. Point number two, David Bowie was the first modern art contemporary art musician.
I'm an alligator. I'm a mama papa coming for you.
Jimi Hendrix called his band the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and Pink Floyd certainly had a stage show mindset. But in truth, no other major rock musician cast themselves as much of an art concept as David Bowie.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars.
Bowie was really the first to challenge his audiences and treat them to a multimedia rock experience. Album, stage show, movies, costume, and film. It wasn't just the music, it was the whole package. And for better or for worse, that's inherent in rock music today.
The content has to astound. I mean, you can dress a show with $1 trillion worth of goodies, but if the show is not substantial, there will be no impact.
I'm afraid of Americans.
Nothing, tra-la-la.
Your Majesty, what a nice surprise.
Is that
David Bowie?
David Bowie, your face.
I believe I might be of service.
But here's the big one, the one where Bowie really stands out. Point number three, David Bowie invented modern musical style. Before David Bowie, musicians got up on stage and they played. Maybe they wore some cool outfits or matching headbands. The Beatles wore matching suits. But that was about it. Bowie blew all of those conventions away. And when he came on stage, he did it in drag. He overturned sexuality. He put on makeup and descended from space. Glam was born, but so was the concept of subculture niche music. The list of bands and acts who could not exist today without David Bowie or trace their style directly to his presentation include, but are not limited to, Kiss, Alice Cooper, Lady Gaga, Nicki Minaj, Miley Cyrus, Susie and the Banshees, Depeche Mode, The Cure. You name it, without these acts, the musical experience isn't the same today, and you can thank David Bowie for that. So there it is, agree or disagree, my vote, David Bowie, the most influential musician living today.
They get the picture? You're laughing now?
He's not a monster. He's a great guy who worked for us for many, many years.
Cut him off.
You ought to be grateful I can still afford to pay your salary.
Check out the big brain on Brad.
I'll send you a nice box of Christmas meat. Best I can do. Get out of here.
And you can do anything, right?
Check out the big brain on Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, who's here to do movies for us here on The Takeaway without Kristen Meinzer.
I know, without my old partner. She's sorry to see her go.
Gone off to another high-profile place in the media. We wish her well, of course. Let's begin with the movies this week. The Forest. Let's hear a clip.
People sometimes see things in the forest. Important to remember. If you see anything bad, anything strange, it is not real.
What is this, realism? Is it a fable? Is it a kid's movie?
Well, it's set in a real place. It's a forest in Japan. It's at the base of Mount Fuji. It's a forest where people go to commit suicide. Real place.
Oh, that's right. I do know about this.
Yeah, sort of famous. And a young woman named Jess goes into the forest to try to find her twin sister. Natalie Dormer plays both Jess and Sarah, the two twins. So, you know, you go into this forest and it starts to play tricks on your mind and, you know, is what you're seeing real or not? I like the premise. I think it's kind of interesting. Interesting, but I have to say the acting is not that great, the directing not that great. A lot of very familiar horror film tropes, the scary old crones and the creepy kids singing, all the familiar stuff that you've seen doesn't really work that well.
45 Years is now believed in some of the reviews to be a masterpiece. Charlotte Rampling, Tom Courtney. Let's hear a clip.
What I want now is for you to just come to the party tomorrow.
Of course I'm going to come.
And I really need you to want to be there.
Yes, I do want to be there.
Because it's one thing me knowing I haven't been enough for you. It's something altogether different that everyone else feels it too.
So this is about a marriage being tested, even though it makes it to the 45th year.
Yes, it's on the eve of their anniversary there, and Jeff, played by Tom Courtney, gets a letter saying that his old girlfriend from years and years ago, when he was a young hippie backpacker type, that her body has been found. She fell to her death in a hiking accident, and her body has finally been found. This was not a secret that from Kate, played by Charlotte Rampling, but somehow the news of this old ghost, comes back and starts to cause Kate to question the validity of their marriage after all this time. It's amazing, amazing film. Very quiet, very hushed film. Charlotte Rampling's extraordinary. Tom Courtney is fantastic. You know, those two have never been on screen before, ever, after all these years. This is their first time. It's a wonderful, wonderful film.
And the premise is a little bit like The Dead, the James Joyce story, where a memory ignites an entire reexamination of a whole life.
It's this is based on a short story, not Joyce, but by an author named David Constantine, who read about someone who was trapped in the ice for all these years, and the retreating ice due to climate change freed the body, perfectly preserved. So there's a little bit of that to it as well.
Rafer Guzman, we're going to end this segment on a business story. Star Wars is a huge behemoth in the movie world, but maybe less than meets the eye.
Maybe a little bit less. People are talking about whether or not it can beat Avatar for the all-time record. So Avatar, $2.78 billion. Pretty extraordinary when you think of that. That's worldwide. Star Wars at this point, $1.58. So quite an uphill climb. It hasn't opened up yet in China, which will be the sort of the last stage of success for it. But, you know, know, I think when you go back and look at all these films that we know as classics, those films have still outpaced actual ticket sales of Star Wars so far, domestically at least, about 88 million actual tickets at this point.
And Titanic, 128 million, E.T., 131 million, Sound of Music, 142 million tickets, and
that's
even the
right.
original Star Wars, 143. What's the big ticket seller?
The biggest one, the top one still after all these years, 200 million tickets sold. Here it is.
I'm going to marry Melanie.
But you can't, not if you care for me.
Oh, my dear, why must you make me say things that will hurt you?
Oh, Ashley, we're Gone with the Wind.
1939, still the top number one for actual tickets sold.
Thanks. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend.
You too, John.
Once a painful secret, today a widely known therapeutic tool, the utterly familiar rituals of 12-step programs can even get kid laughs in Disney movies, like Finding Nemo.
The meeting has officially come to order. Let us all say the pledge. I am a nice shark, not a mindless eating machine. If I am to change this image, I must first change myself. Fish are friends, not food.
AA, or Alcoholics Anonymous, is not derived from any scientific theory of psychology or psychiatry. And even today, the medical community remains reluctant to fully embrace its effectiveness in treating the estimated 16.5 million adults aged 18 and over who have an alcohol use disorder, or AUD as it's known. Two men, both admitted drunks, pioneered Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1935. That story is told in the play Bill W. and Dr. Bob, that returns to the off-Broadway stage in a historic collaboration with New York University's Langone Medical Center. A hospital is signed on and is funding a theatrical event about a treatment program in the hopes of opening the doors to treatment for some of the folks who come to laugh and learn and see themselves in a new way. Samuel Shem is co-writer and producer and a professor of medicine and psychiatry at New York University's Langone Medical Center.
My wife and I, in 1986, came across the story of Bill Wilson and Bob Smith, the founders of AA, and we immediately saw it as a play. We saw it starting with a guy standing up on one side of the stage saying, "My name is Bill W. and I'm an alcoholic. At a time like this, I wish my partner could be here." I'm talking about the man we all call, opposite side of the stage, spot up, "Dr. Bob, alcoholic, good to be here sober." Because some of the audience is in 12-step programs, they shout out, "Hi, Bill." So it was like a meeting, you know, it broke the fourth wall of the theater immediately. They start to tell their stories like they're at meetings, and then the play is their stories, and then at the end they finish their stories.
You know, if you go to a medical convention, you can find doctors who, you know, "Please ask me about, nephrology. Please ask me about cardiac care. Please ask me about, you know, skin tumors." But ask them about addiction and they like go running for the hills. So you have embraced something that the medical profession has had real difficulty with.
Well, the truth is the patients that doctors dislike the most are alcoholics and addicts, because they come into the emergency room, you work like hell to save them, they go out and then they're back the next week. So I had that attitude. But then when I was training to be a psychiatrist, I kind of by chance got referred a lot of alcoholics and addicts, and I heard about AA. I didn't know anything about it. So I figured I had to learn. So I started going to AA meetings. I said, "Oh my God, I'm seeing more transformation of character in these people from all walks of life, including doctors, than I've ever seen in my psychiatric practice." And in 20 years of working with alcoholics and addicts, I never had a failure. I found if you take out the alcohol or the drug, you've got a person there. And actually, someone who actually is quite skillful because they kept their life going pretty much while, you know, drinking.
Is part of this a personal connection to addiction in any way, or is it just your observations as a scientist?
What I realized going to these AA meetings, just listening, one day I said to myself, "Hey, wait a second. Maybe you got a problem." I never thought I had a problem. I hadn't lost anything. But what I did was I decided, okay, this is when I was about 45, I'm going to stop. And I went to meetings. Haven't had a drink in 26 years. And my life, even though I wasn't really bad, my life changed totally. And then looking back, I said, I should have been dead many times because I was drunk.
You see, once you embrace sobriety, a lot of people talked about this, that suddenly you look around and all of society is about drinking. Everywhere you look. It must, from the perspective of a doctor, be extraordinarily frustrating that you're trying to save people and, like, people are pushing poison.
Yeah. Alcohol is a very special kind of drug because it gives you the illusion of connection while you're disconnecting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons that there's an epidemic of binge drinking on college campuses, because the social pressure of the screen generation, the social anxiety is high, especially cross-gender, so they get loaded before they go to the parties. But this brings me to the play, which I'd love to talk about, because we set out to write this play with two goals. One, this is a story you cannot believe. The way these guys happened to meet is just unbelievable. So we had to write a historically accurate play.
Right.
The second thing was we had to write a great play so that people would come and see it. A lot of it rides on humor because in some ways it's kind of funny it's so bad.
The fact that this is being done off-Broadway in its traditional theatrical setting, does it allow you to get out of the medical bubble? You know, students might get an impact out of it, but it's nothing like actually going into the real world and sitting next to someone you don't know in the audience.
Yeah, this play, you get someone sitting there in the first row with a $99 ticket from, you know, Wall Street. And then because we give away tickets to people who don't have any money who are in treatment, you have, you know, a guy who's been in jail. It's just this mixture of people. It works because it's just a damn good play. It's an incredible success story. It has a happy ending. I want to say what they discovered, just two things.
Sure, sure. No spoilers, though.
No. This isn't a spoiler. No. They found it AA. That, we know that. No, two things they did discover. Bill Wilson, he discovered that the only thing that could keep a drunk sober was telling his story to another drunk. May or may not help the other guy, but it will keep you sober. And Dr. Bob said, our service keeps us sober, serving other people, which is a great humanitarian rule for all of society, which we've lost. The other amazing thing I didn't realize, they discovered that alcoholism is a disease with physical, psychological, and spiritual elements, and it had to be treated in all three arenas.
Before we go, have you ever thought of taking on heroin? That's a huge issue in America right now.
You know, it's interesting you say that because, in fact, compared to alcohol and the total cost of alcohol in terms of broken families, violence, car accidents, you know, you name it, is much, much, much more serious than heroin. Heroin is right now. It's a big problem. I'm not denying that. But the American Psychiatric Association just came out with a report. This last year, there was more alcohol abuse, more alcoholism than the past 35 years.
Oh,
so it's going up. And in colleges, it's an epidemic. You know, I just would like to say, you know, if you don't know anything about AA, fine. If you know something about AA, fine. But you're going to be in this audience with people, as they say, from Yale to jail. The other first for this production is that it's binational, bilingual. The same actors do productions in English and do productions in Spanish. They're bilingual. Three from Costa Rica, three from New York City, because we wanted to serve the Latino community because they don't often go to theater, but alcohol is a big problem. They go to AA. This is a labor of love for me. I'm so glad to be able to talk about it.
Well, I can tell. Samuel Shem is co-writer and co-producer of Bill W. and Dr. Bob, a.k.a. Dr. Steven Bergman, professor of medicine and psychiatry at NYU Langone Medical Center. Here's something to take with you today. The Washington Post reports that more than 30,000 people who believe they have problems with alcohol are choosing an internet version of AA. Reddit's r Stop Drinking domain is becoming a real community. The support I saw in Stop Drinking on day one felt like nothing I'd experienced in hundreds of AA or SMART meetings, says a member. 31,339 subscribing members plus untold thousands who view the forum but don't subscribe. One in five say R Stop Drinking is their sole support group, and most say they visit multiple times a month. There are badges, congratulatory notes, written by the forum's six moderators celebrating every day since each user's last drink. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRN. Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.